Well, welcome back, everybody. Great digital leaders know what good looks like. In fact, they have the ability to see patterns, to connect the dots, and to see around corners to shape what good looks like for their organization. In order to do all this, you have to know what matters. My guest today is Brian Abramson, someone I would describe as humbly brilliant when it comes to knowing exactly that, what matters. Brian is the Chief Digital Officer and the Associate Laboratory Director for the Pacific Northwest National Laboratory, otherwise known as PNNL. Brian has a huge job you're going to come to see here shortly and is responsible for leading the institution on a digital transformation journey that brings to bear technology innovation that is differentiating PNNL as a globally recognized research institution. So Brian, welcome to the podcast. Great to have you here. I've been looking forward to this for a long, long time. Your website describes the lab in this way, where great minds meet great challenges. So let's start there. Can you provide more context around this big, bold statement and tell us why PNNL matters?
Yeah, no, thanks, Dan. You know, PNNL is an amazing place. As someone who spent my entire career in the private sector, I wasn't sure what to expect, to be honest with you, when I came here. In fact, I remember walking through the door and seeing the mission statement, which is to transform the world through discovery and innovation, and almost being a bit skeptical of how bold that was. And I've learned in the intervening years that it's absolutely what we do. And so, you know, PNNL is a national lab. We've got Northwest groups, but with global reach. And we do a few things. So one is we have a conduct research in fundamental science. So we're in that sense, we're advancing kind of humankind's understanding in fields like chemistry, material science, biology, et cetera. We also do work in advancing sustainable energy solutions for the planet. So focusing on things like decarbonization, energy storage, looking at the resilience and the protection of things like our power grid. And then finally, we do a lot of work in national security. So this is a significant portion of our research portfolio. And so when you think about things like nuclear and radiological security, critical infrastructure protection, addressing chemical and biological threats, all of that's in this portfolio. And, you know, what I found is that I think, like most of us, have worked with a lot of brilliant people in my career. We all have. But this is different because when you take some of the brightest minds with the passion to solve these grand challenges that matter, boy, that passion with that kind of brilliance in this mission, it really does transform the world. And so it's a great place. It's the first time in my career that I've worked for kind of a purely mission-driven organization, and I'll never go back. It's been a really wonderful experience.
Well, there's a lot of layers to the organization. I've known it for many, many years. Just such impressive people there. I think you may have already answered the question, but, you know, knowing your why matters. This is a podcast about what matters. And, you know, what's your why and how do you use that to energize your people?
My why is pretty simple. I want to help our people stay focused on what they came here to do, which is change the world. You know, a chemist didn't come here to get stuck in a procurement process. A data scientist didn't come here to spend days or weeks trying to get access to the right tools, right? These people came here to do chemistry. They came here to do data science. That's what matters. And so for me, that's the why. And making my why a reality means reducing viscosity in the workplace, right? Simplifying how we work, bringing that to bear through a digital workplace. I think there's tremendous opportunities for technology leaders to truly streamline these environments and allow people to do what they came here to do. And in my experience, Dan, there's nothing more motivating than seeing their work make a difference. And so for the technologists and IT professionals and computing professionals, right, being a part of a team whose accomplishments are not just celebrated by me, but by the broader laboratory, and seeing their tradecraft make that difference, get that chemist back to the benchtop. I think that's what motivates folks. And you know, we've worked really hard over the years to establish a repeatable playbook for driving institutional change that gets celebrated. And when a team can get into that rhythm of driving change, having that change celebrated, and get it onto that kind of virtuous cycle, it's almost addictive. And we've had a lot of fun with that.
That's incredible. You know, any CIO, chief digital officer worth their salt today has got the proverbial seat at the table. But, you know, the magic today, or what matters today, is how do we get our C-suite around the digital table? And so I actually have a couple of mystery questioners. The first one is going to help us tee up a question on this topic. So listen in, tell us who this is, and I know you'll appreciate the question.
Hi, Brian. How do you approach communicating with your peers and persuading them on the value and importance of digitally enabling and accelerating the laboratory's mission and business?
All right. Well, that is Jerry Cochran. He is our director for cybersecurity and digital operations at Pacific Northwest National Lab. He's also part of our secret sauce. Frankly, he's the definition of hiring someone smarter than you. And so it's a great question. I guess I see the way that I approach this through a few different a few ways. So first is, I think what's really important is to approach the work we do through the lens of kind of this Maslow's hierarchy concept, meaning we have to build trust by nailing the basics first before we have the credibility to pursue more advanced goals. And when I think about working with the executives around our table, if I'm not delivering on the basic needs, there's no other interest in conversation that they want to have, right? They're not interested in the discussion on the higher order investments or strategies if the fundamentals aren't right. And so I think one of the things we've done is we've spent a lot of time, years in fact, getting the fundamentals right. And that becomes permission to play in some of the higher order endeavors. You know, I think the second is in building trust through the recognition that actions speak louder than words. I know we all say that, and that's an age old sentiment, but you know, I have to deliver on my commitments and my organization's commitments and do what we say we're going to do. And so, you know, as technology leaders, our impact can be very tangible. It can be seen and it can be felt. And so when you deliver on those commitments, it's noticed. And when you don't, it's also noticed. And so I think that second for me is really building trust through delivering on the commitments. And finally, I think the last one for me in this context is getting the executives involved in the discussion. You know, it was interesting when I came to P&L, all of our governance for technology investments was at a mid-level management committee. And that's a really common thing. I found that time and again, as I've worked with different organizations. And while it was well-intended, what it was actually doing is excluding the C-suite from the discussion. And so tooling that to where you have the executive team personally involved in shaping the digital agenda, I think that's just absolutely critical in having their perspective, their voice, kind of co-creating what those investments, what those priorities are going to be, what success looks like, what those outcomes are, and elevating that discussion, that dialogue in this day and age.
I think we could do an entire podcast just on what you just talked about. That was very, very rich. And Jerry, thanks so much for the question. Really, really well done. And we have another mystery questioner, Brian, to help really unpack your superpowers. And you know, I would preface it by saying your peers, the folks you work with across the lab, we can already tell they've got big jobs, right? Big brains, they're running businesses, their priorities shift over time. So keeping them engaged for the long haul matters, right? So let's listen in to another mystery questioner, their perspective. I think they've got a front row seat and we'll be able to tee this up really well for us. So listen in.
Brian, one of your superpowers is your ability to see the big picture and dive deep into the weeds technically. You're also gifted with the ability to look at things from a user standpoint, which is sometimes a struggle for IT folks to master. You're perceived at P&L among the Battelle-operated labs and within the wider DOE complex as a thought leader. Given your depth of technical knowledge, how do you temper that to ensure your messages resonate with a wide range of audiences?
That's a big one. Who's that?
That is a great question. So that is none other than Mary Lynn. So she is my right-hand executive assistant. And, you know, we've been together for over a decade. She's the reason I get anything done, quite frankly. And so, yeah, very, very good question.
I've had some fun with that. And, you know, it's always dangerous when she and Tracy get together because you and I get in trouble when that happens.
That's right. That's right. Well, you know, to the question, I mean, I think what really helps me sometimes connect with different audiences is my habit of listening. And, you know, I spend a lot of time talking to people from all walks of life, engineers, end users, scientists, stakeholders, managers, and really working hard to try to absorb their perspectives. It's a bit like piecing together a puzzle where every individual piece matters, but what is that mosaic kind of telling you, if you will? You know, when I communicate, one of the things I work hard to do is strip away the fluff and focus on what's important to them, to the individuals I'm speaking with, using simple analogies and visuals to make complex ideas click. You know, it's fascinating to me that even working in an environment where we've got, you know, an enormous number of, you know, PhDs and just brilliant individuals in their fields, it doesn't mean that they're technical in my field. And so, you know, how can I use simple analogies, you know, comparing a cybersecurity measure to a lock on a front door, something everybody can understand, and making the message clear and relevant so that it sticks with somebody long after the conversation is over. And you know, if I can do that, I can bridge the gap between the technical world and the real world impact and making sure that everybody's on the same page and is excited about where we're headed. And sometimes I think that's I think listening is an underused superpower, quite frankly. So I think that's part of it. You know, the other is frankly not overwhelming the message with too much detail. I think sometimes people confuse specificity for clarity. And I work hard to avoid that. And I think if I can accomplish that, frankly, it really helps kind of connect with different audiences.
Don't confuse specificity with clarity. So good. And strip away the fluff, speak to the different audiences. And I think people are getting a good sense of why you're very strong in this communication area. And thank you, Mary Lynn, for actually, she was my partner in crime with all these mystery questioners. And we had some fun with that. So thanks to her. You know, I'd love to have you talk about the computing imperatives. You know, you've really articulated with, you know, with great detail, great clarity. So maybe just kind of highlight what those are to help people think about how you make what matters matter.
You know, when we think about computing as a national laboratory, we think about it in two dimensions. So one is we're managing and operating a national lab. That's a complex business, and we have the same set of kind of back office and functional organizations that most large enterprises would have. So that's one part of our focus that I'll talk about. But the other is, you know, the very conduct of research is going through its own digital transformation. And so how do we think about that? And so from my perspective, it's really looking at both sides of that coin. So, you know, the first is this notion of what we call digital business transformation. So this is what most of us would think about as the digital transformation of the enterprise. So looking across all of our functional organizations and where we're at. And for us, it really boils down to one thing. How do we reduce viscosity in the environment? And so the opportunity here is to look at a lot of our processes, our legacy systems, and mold those into contemporary digital platforms that really transform that employee experience. So for us, you know, this digital business transformation is of the different imperatives that we have at the laboratory, it's the largest and it's the most foundational. And to use a phrase I used earlier, right, it's also permission to play into the rest of what we do in terms of the digital transformation of research. And so that's an ongoing journey for us at PNNL. The other is then around kind of what does this transformation of research look like? When you think about, you know, computationally enabled research, this is impacting every one of our scientific and research domains and disciplines. And for us, it really boils down to five things that we're focused on. So one is data stewardship. I think for a lot of reasons, right, we generate tremendous amounts of data in all fields of study and research that we do. How do we make sure that we are curating and managing those assets in a way that they can be brought forth to maybe reproduce, to share with other institutions, reproduce our research, to leverage in the fields of, you know, AI and ML and some of the dependencies we have there. The second for us is what we call automation and autonomy. So, you know, the future of laboratory-based science holds significant potential in terms of autonomous or automation inside the laboratory environment itself. And so when we think about kind of this intersection of things like robotics, interconnected equipment, augmented interaction, enhanced safety systems, digital assistance inside the laboratory, et cetera, all of that, think about kind of the smart lab of the future is kind of encompassed in this notion of automation and autonomy for us. The third is cloud computing. Cloud plays an interesting role in scientific discovery. So, you know, while we leverage cloud in the digital business transformation element, also when we think about the conduct of research, we have hundreds of research programs that are innovating in the cloud and using the services and capabilities of those environments inside of those hyperscalers to really accelerate their own work. And so how do we bring those cloud assets and platforms to bear so that the research community can easily adopt, leverage, and scale up some of what they're doing. The fourth for us is around software engineering automation. We view software engineering as something that frankly happens across many of our research disciplines and programs. And how do we make sure that those software engineers across the institution are equipped with the right kind of software engineering platforms, automations? You think about things like CI/CD, et cetera. This matters a lot. And we don't want our folks out kind of duct tape and baling wire together the tools they need. We want them to have contemporary environments. And then finally, Dan, the last one for us is this notion of artificial intelligence to accelerate research. You don't go long day in without a conversation without AI coming into the mix. And so when we think about this, especially today, right, this disruption that's happening, it really has implications in research and development. And so how do we address both the opportunities and the risks through a laboratory level focus on accelerating AI adoption lab-wide? So those together collectively are what we call our imperatives, those six elements. And the last thing I'll say is that on those imperatives, those aren't Brian's imperatives. Those are not my organization's imperatives. Those are P&L's imperatives. And I think that's a really important distinction as we think about our strategy is, you know, co-creating what those imperatives are as an institution so that the institution owns those. We're simply playing a stewardship role to help advance on each of those fronts.
So good. You know, I love that vision for the smart lab of the future, you know, because the stuff that you do really matters and setting people up for success. We've talked a bunch about the what matters. You talked about why matters. You're very Jeff Bezos-like when it comes to thinking about and executing on the how, because the how matters. How do you think about that, Brian? How do you execute on that?
You know, I guess one of the lessons that I've learned is that while the what is incredibly important, it's the how that really drives success. And the way I think about it is this. So the why gives you clarity and direction, right? It's your North Star. It's the reason you're doing what you're doing. But the how, I think that's where the magic happens. It's the process, the execution, the steps you take to turn an idea into reality. I will say that, you know, my focus on the how is almost an obsession for me. And I love it because I believe the details make all the difference. So when we're tackling a solution, you know, I'll dive deep with my team into every aspect ensuring that each component is well thought out and executed. And it's more than just getting the job done. It's about how we get the job done, the precision and the simplicity that we can bring into that experience. And looking at everything we do as what kind of experience is that generating for somebody on the other side. And so, in terms of communication, right, when we talk about our solutions, our products, our innovations, right, how do we make sure that every message is clear, concise, and tailored to the audience? I often say, you know, why send a message to 700 people if 70 need to receive it, right? So how do we do those targeted communications, make them highly relevant, and strip away, you know, jargon and complexity, right? So really find that simplicity and that clarity in our messaging. That often means from a messaging perspective, right, breaking down complex ideas and understandable parts using visuals, lots of analogies that resonate with everyone, whether they're technical experts or end users. I think another part of our how is constantly asking, you know, how can we make this simpler and more effective, right? So how do we really take a look at an end-to-end process and understand the waste and the flow? How do we start to understand, what are the unnecessary steps we can eliminate? Really look at that, as I said earlier, that user experience. And at the end of the day, you know, I often say that, you know, simplicity is a really easy thing to say. It's a hard thing to do. In other words, it's really easy to make something hard and it's really hard to make something simple. And so how do we, enable ourselves to unpack and deconstruct the ways we work today and reconstruct those in a way that achieve that simplification and give us that benefit. So anyways, I think that's a little bit on the how. You know, when I think about maybe just one quick story on this, it was a number of years ago, pre-pandemic, and you know, I had a research staff member that was telling me a story about a meeting that he had disrupted. And what was interesting is, you know, we looked at this as well, you know, a console in a conference room failed once. And it was, I'm sure that was a metric or statistic somewhere on a dashboard somewhere. But at the end of the day, what we disrupted in that case was a meeting that had been scheduled 6 months in advance. It had luminaries from around the world coming together to discuss a really important topic that frankly matter to the planet. And when that meeting failed, we set that program back. And that wasn't just a statistic, right? That was, and what was my aha was like, that's a story. That's something you feel. You don't feel statistics, but you do feel stories. And every one of the meetings we were disrupting had that story behind it. And so, you know, that actually led us down the path of looking at our conference rooms as a simple example to say, how do we get to it just works experience, right? You know, consistency across the board. You walk in, you don't have to think about the technology. I tell you, that's been one of the more successful endeavors that we've done, especially coming post-pandemic. But it was incredibly hard to achieve that. And at the end of the day, it wasn't one big thing. It wasn't a product or a technology that we bought that was the secret sauce. It was 100 little things that we did that made that experience what it is today.
So rich, you know, I think was it Steve Jobs who talked about simplicity? Like, I think he said simplicity is the ultimate sophistication or something like that, right? Kind of what your point is. And a good reminder too, that it doesn't matter how many nines of uptime, right? It's that one meeting mattered. And
that's right.
Yeah. So it's not going to show up on a dashboard. You know, I think part of your success story is being intentional about principles, leadership principles. I think it's a lost art. It used to be, you know, 20, 30 years ago, leaders would have their core principles. I always tell this story. Carl Wilson, when he went from Georgia Pacific up to the Marriott Corporation, knew Carl very well, phenomenal CIO. The only thing in his briefcase was his one page leadership principles. That's all he went with. And so, tell us about yours. Why is it so important to you? Maybe give us a couple of examples.
Yeah, no, it's a great question. I think, you know, I look at principles as when done well, right? They can be really the backbone of success. They help to infuse the how into everything we do to our prior discussion, shaping actions and decisions. And I think the job of my job, and I think the job of any leader, is to role model those principles every day, right? And help them become part of the DNA of how an organization thinks and works. And so, you know, for us, I think, and for me, having principles that also plainly drive, they're clear, and they clearly drive actions and behaviors. I think that for me is, you know, if I can't make a connection between a principle and a set of actions or behaviors that an individual or a team might take, then I don't think I have the right principle. And I'll give you some examples of what we leverage. So one is one of our first principles is always focusing on bringing forward effortless and personal experiences. And so, you know, I've talked a lot about the art of simplicity, but again, people are at a national lab to do what they came here to do. They're not here to get caught in convoluted experiences of viscosity. And so really looking at the kind of the effortless nature of the experiences we put forward. The other angle on that one is the level of personalization that we can bring to the table. Don't look at, you know, our staff as just numbers or segments. These are individuals that are here to do important work. And how do we really personalize the level of experience that we do? You know, a second principle for us is this notion of we know first. You know, it was interesting in a past life when I worked in the utility sector at a power company. That day and age, the reason we knew the power went out is by triangulating inbound phone calls from customers. This was before smart meters, before we had the kind of intelligence on the grid to tell us that we had an outage. And the same holds true in the IT world. How do we know first about the poor experiences that somebody's having, about the hiccups that are occurring out there, about some of the issues that we're having? And so really, you know, leveraging analytics and proactive monitoring to help us identify issues before somebody calls. And so this notion of we know first broadly applies to almost everything we do. I think another one for us is this notion of, you know, bad things don't happen twice. And so bad things are always going to happen. But I think what's really important is that when we stumble, right, we can move forward with lightweight after action reviews, right? Timely corrective actions, things that prevent recurrence, and make that just part of our rhythm, just part of what we do. It's not a blame game. It's nobody's in trouble. Just really unpacking and understanding. And that can be, you know, a technical failure. That can be maybe a failure on a project. That can be a product that maybe didn't land quite right in terms of what we released. And so this notion of kind of continuous improvement through that. And I think maybe another one for us is, you know, visible, nimble, and effective change. And so for what this means, a couple of things for us is, you know, one, when we're deploying change to the laboratory, right, on both the technical level and at the human level, we're minimizing disruption by taking a very thoughtful approach. So when you think about, you know, the technical change management, right, this is making sure that when we're deploying new capabilities into the environment, we're doing it in a way that isn't disruptive. But equally as important from a people change management perspective, how do we make sure that we understand where we might be getting resistance? Whose cheese are we moving? How do we approach that change in a way that we help the people accept, adopt, and perhaps, you know, change ways of working. So those are just a few examples, Dan. We've got, you know, five or six of these principles, but our principles are really designed to inform how we think and how we work on a day-to-day basis and it's a mindset, if you will, that we bring into the solutions that we create for the institution.
I think a lot of good teachings there. We know first is pretty special. It's not we know best, which is a big difference, right? So I know the other thing I want to highlight, and you're really good at this, is going back to the trust. But you live these. You keep them front and center. You demonstrate them. You model them. And those organizations where that doesn't happen, that's when you start to see cynicism. People start to, you know, it's like, hey, where's the boss living this out? And so you do that very well.
Well, and you know, one interesting example of this, I think, for us is a number of years ago, we set out to reimagine our frontline support. So this is what we previously had called our IT help desk. But we reimagined this in something we call Tech Desk. And in looking at those principles, right, we transformed this in a few ways. First of all, even simple things like when you call us, just answer the phone, right? Why put a menu in front of people, push one for this, two for this, three for this, if you're not doing skills-based routing and things like that? Cross-train your individuals. We can capture that information as you get there. When you come to us for solutions and you need help, right? How do we think about the things that matter? So for example, as part of our Tech Desk solution, we deployed Genius Bar-like locations across our campuses where you can walk in. 30 minutes later, you can have a loaner. Same day, you can have a new computer. You can go on, it's almost like a retail-like experience to get your peripherals and things like that. That's what matters to people. When somebody is without a computer, that 30-minute window matters, right? When you need that dongle, when you need that power supply, that mouse went bad on you, to go through an ordering process and wait a week or a few days, those are the kinds of things that get really hard. So when we think about, you know, making things effortless, you know, also on the Tech Desk, we launched an entire program around proactive monitoring. And so if somebody's battery is draining faster than it should be, how do we, you know, we reach out and say, hey, it looks like you might be having some issues. If we're seeing blue screens of death occur multiple times over, it's amazing to me how many people don't reach out because they have a high tolerance for pain. So people, you know, some people reach out consistently, but people generally don't reach out until they hit something that they may consider catastrophic, right? To say, you know, I'll put up with a lot of pain, but then at some point I have to call for help. Well, if we can intercept that call for help earlier and say, hey, we're noticing these issues that you're having, let us help you. That for us has been a bit magical in terms of the effect. And so, you know, even applying those principles to something like frontline support for us has been a really interesting journey.
Well, as your website says, your people do, we do big, smart, hard things that matter. And when you're down, that's not happening. So yeah, it's, you know, I want to shift gears a little bit, Brian. And the lab opened up an AI center to boost the use of AI in research, especially around science and security energy. So maybe just kind of talk about that, you know, in terms of why P&L believes this matters so much.
AI is a game changer, and you know, bottom line is, you know, P&L is all in, and this is a big focus for us as an institution. And you know, the artificial intelligence and machine learning and deep learning, some of these things are not new, right? I think, you know, ourselves and many institutions like us have been working in these fields for, you know, a decade or two. But there's a lot of innovation that's happening in the space over the last several years, and we see that continuing. And for us, I think as a national lab, we have an interesting angle here because we're not after the commercialization or the monetization of elements around artificial intelligence, right? So it's not about how do we monetize these advancements for financial gain. We really look at it from the perspective of you know, two elements. One is how do we accelerate scientific discovery? So we think there's, you know, significant opportunities to accelerate scientific discovery through artificial intelligence and doing so by applying this to the work we do in climate science, to the work we do to discover new battery materials, to help accelerate some of our work in material science or national security, et cetera. And so, you know, for us, in part, that means bringing the right kinds of platforms, education, tools, capability, partnerships to bear for the laboratory that can help accelerate our mission through artificial intelligence. Another dimension for us is actually advancing the field of AI itself. And for us, we really look at that through a focus on AI safety, security, and ethical use, right? Ensuring that it benefits society in a responsible way. And you know, there's a lot of organizations on the planet that are looking at the monetization. There's not as many organizations, right, looking at how we do this safely, securely, and ethically. And I think this is where the national laboratories, you know, writ large, have a really unique opportunity. And in fact, you know, if you saw in the executive order from the president recently, right, it has a significant focus on AI safety and security. And that's really a place that that we focus.
I've got another couple of mystery questions. This next one, I think you'll appreciate the question and the questioner. It kind of gets taking this AI question on a different path, or in a path that matters to you, because you're all about people, your people. So listen in and see what you think about this.
How should tech leaders approach the potential disruption AI may bring to the workforce?
All right. Yes, I do recognize that. That is Brian Vladimirov. He's our enterprise solutions architect, but and maybe not everybody will understand this reference, but he's the literally the MacGyver of IT, if one ever existed. And you know, Brian is somebody that no matter what the situation is, right, he devises a solution. But it's a great question. So, you know, at the end of the day, when I think about the potential disruption to the workforce, one thing that's often said and that I often repeat is it's not the AI that's going to replace you. It's the person using the AI that's going to replace you. And so how do we bring the workforce along the journey of some of what we're seeing in terms of advancements and do so with kind of this blend of optimism and responsibility, right? So you know, focusing on the upskilling of our teams, making sure that, you know, we're prepared to work alongside of some of the new AI-driven capabilities we're seeing come online, you know, foster this kind of this culture of curiosity and continuous learning. But the goal is to harness the artificial intelligence to enhance human potential, not replace. And I think having that kind of clarity is important. And taking it slow and doing a lot of experimentation. I think for us at the institution, you know, this is a fail fast, experiment often, you know, kind of mode, right? We in fact, just this last week, we released something we call the AI Research Assistant. Early indications are it's going to be an incredible capability. It's an agentic AI workflow, meaning kind of an autonomous AI workflow. You give it a topic, just a sentence. One of the bots will go off and actually research that topic and divide it into subtopics. It'll hand those subtopics onto 3 to 5 additional bots, agents, if you will, that will go on and conduct their research, report back, and then an orchestrator will bring it all together in a summary report, fully cited with references. And in our case, we're actually restricting all of the source material to something like Google Scholar. So you've got a set of source material that is published peer-reviewed research, and you dramatically reduce instances of hallucination and things like that. So even in things like that, it's a research assistant. It's not the AI researcher, right? It's not doing the research for us, but it's giving a leg up to somebody that might be wanting to go do some research on some topic, you know, get a bunch of source material back that can accelerate what they're doing. So that's a bit about how we think about you know, approaching that disruption that I know folks are concerned about.
Yeah, it's interesting. In a few weeks, I'm going to be out at the CI 100 Awards event at the Broadmoor Hotel in Colorado Springs. It's where the CIO Hall of Fame inductees get announced, the 100 winners of the Innovation Awards. And this leadership masterclass that I have the privilege of leading there, one of the topics is going to be around going slow to go fast. And you know, you just mentioned that. I just want to double click on it because I think there's so much hype around this. I think people make a lot of mistakes, a lot of pressure, you know, got a lot of the air out of the balloon and slowing the game down. I think the Navy SEALs call it, what do they say? It's slow is smooth and smooth is fast, right? And that's kind of what you're doing there.
Absolutely. You know, I think that and staying connected with, you know, other institutions, colleagues and peers, you know, outside of our respective organizations to understand their own journey on this topic. Because I think to your point, there's whenever you get something that's this much hyped or that is hyped to this degree, the pressure to move fast. I want what the Joneses have. I heard this. I heard that. And you know, I think that can result you know, just as you've described, right, moving fast to a fault, and so I think this is a, you know, slow and steady, but again, lots of experimentation and making failure okay in this realm is I think, you know, important in anything we do, but I think particularly in this space.
Yeah. You know, the joke used to be it was always a bad day when the CEO came back from a flight and tore an article out of the airline magazine, right? There was something
that's right.
And they gave it to you. It's like, uh-oh, we got to go figure this out. But
yes, exactly.
So, Brian, one more mystery questioner for you. And I want to, for context, in the introduction, I talked about your titles, but I didn't talk about the responsibilities. And there's many. I want people to have this in mind as they listen to this question. You have responsibilities for computing, for information technology, user experience design, program management, cybersecurity, system engineering, and more. And so let's listen in to this great question, and folks can appreciate where this is coming from.
Between keeping abreast of industry trends and the wall of emails that hit your inbox, do you have any best practices for managing the massive flow of information that you need to consume?
Well, that was Kirby Emmerker. She is our lead for people change management at Pacific Northwest National Laboratory. And she leads a practice in helping people adapt to change. And she does that in conjunction with our program management office that oversees a lot of our large change initiatives at the institution that is part of my organization. So great question. I don't know that there's any magic answer with respect to, I think, what we all face in just in terms of kind of information overload. And for me, I think about this from two perspectives. One is it's incredibly important as a technology leader, to stay abreast of trends and movement in our field, and I cannot let the tyranny of the urgent overtake that. And so I do that two different ways. So one is how I set up my news feeds, and so there was a long time when I was kind of a news junkie, right? I was I was constantly scanning the headlines and digesting tidbits of information from traditional news and media sources. And a number of years ago, I retooled all that, and my feeds still come in. I could still consider myself a junkie, but instead of traditional news, it's technology news, and it's stuff that's relevant to my field. So as I've kind of rehoned, if you will, those feeds coming in, it's just an ability for me to consume in kind of bite-sized pieces and chunks and stay abreast. The other thing that I do on that front is I then set aside a time. I do a little research project once a week. And so I'll do this on a Sunday afternoon. And it's a topic that during the course of the prior week, I found interesting. Sometimes it could be a comment that an engineer made. A while back, it was, I wanted to learn more about software-defined networking. In a lot of the, as I've worked to become more proficient in some of the rapid advancements in artificial intelligence, I've done a number of these, kind of research projects. And all a research project is me spending a couple hours, a few hours perhaps, in an afternoon and just watching a bunch of YouTube videos, Googling, reading, finding some good papers, finding folks on LinkedIn that I can follow that are experts in that topic. And so every research project, typically, one, helps me understand something a bit more, but two, has a residual effect because maybe I found a couple more people I want to follow that then, flow into those feeds or whatnot. So one aspect for me in the information overload is we have information overload in our field, right? And how do I stay current and abreast of what's happening? So those are just two simple techniques. I think the other for me then is the tyranny of the urgent, is the daily deluge of, emails and tasks and to-dos and whatnot. I think there, the thing that I've come to appreciate is just the importance of kind of personal organization and having a system or a mechanism. I'm somebody that happens to use the Microsoft ecosystem for everything I do. So I live in my to-do app. My to-do app is connected to my inbox and my flagging, my OneNote. I can flag my tasks in OneNote. I use planner boards at the institution. So having some structure, and there's a lot of different ways people can do that, but having some structure around how I understand my to-dos, And then finally, for me, I think it's also about prioritizing how and where I respond to things. So I often tell people, if you send me an email, you may not get a response the day of, but I guarantee that I've read it that day. And so before I turn in for the day, right, that inbox has been read and then binned in terms of, the urgent, the important, things that might be able to wait a few days, for an engagement or response. And it's not a perfect system, but it allows me to stay current with, you know, what I'm seeing, what come in near real time, but then be able to make some decisions on how I prioritize. So it is challenging, but I've found that, you know, increasingly as I've moved through my career, the importance of having kind of a personal organization system is critical. But coupling that with, you know, having the time and the mechanisms to stay current and relevant in my field, because I've there's been times in my career, frankly, where I felt like the tyranny of the urgent overtook the latter, and that's not a good thing for us as technology leaders.
Yeah, we can fall behind very fast, right? And Kirby, amazing question. And I love what you said, Brian, about the research project, that discipline, that diligence. It just speaks to the curiosity, leaders as learners. And I think it kind of tees up my next question, because you're always about innovating 5 to 10 years out. You're not innovating for today. You're always, Bob Johansson Institute for the Future calls it future back thinking, but you're always out there number of years. So talk about that in the context of your Tech Fest. You run this annual Tech Fest for the entire lab, I believe. I think it just happened in April, a huge undertaking. What's your goal there? What happens there? And what's the magic behind it?
Yeah, no, it's a really fun event for us. So, first of all, I think as a national lab, we don't compete with industry. So we're not about trying to innovate on the time scale where industry is at. And so we place ourselves ahead a number of years to be, pretty forward leaning especially in fields around kind of computing and technology. And so TechFest is an opportunity where it's a celebration of computing is what we call it. We bring computational folks together from all walks of life across all missions, whether you're a computational chemist or somebody working in national security, cyber defense, or somebody that's looking at, how do I improve grid resilience through artificial intelligence, right? And so we bring these folks together once a year in this event that we call TechFest. And really what it is, it's a platform for sharing the latest technology developments, sparking innovation, fostering collaboration across a laboratory. We get well over 1,000 folks that come together. And really what they're able to do is showcase cutting edge technologies, what they're doing, kind of their applications. And we do so in a number of ways. So lots of different forms. So we have, people submit traditional abstracts. So we'll have hundreds of the abstracts submitted for this event. And then we have a selection committee, kind of a cross-lab selection committee that will select folks to come in and give talks. But at the same time, we do a lot of quick fires. So quick fires can be 5 and 10 minute kind of rapid fire. So you might hear about 10 topics in the course of 90 minutes, right? And it's just this kind of rapid fire, and it's designed to just pique the interest. If two of those 10 things you just heard about are interesting, now you know the name and the person to go make that contact, right? I think the other thing that we do is we do a lot of what we call kind of these roundtable discussions. So we literally will get 20 or 40 people sitting in a huge circle in chairs, and somebody's facilitating this conversation on a topic. So it's a deep dive on a topic. And it doesn't always have to be just a tech topic. We've done these on topics around diversity and inclusion and other types of things that are important to the competing workforce we have. And then finally, we also do a lot of workshops at this. In fact, we've taken TechFest and we've added a day we call Cloud Day now. We have got Amazon, Microsoft, and Google, all three partners. And in fact, in our Discovery Hall, we call it, it's our large conference facility. Simultaneously, we'll have workshops being led by each of those three organizations side by side with hundreds of people participating, in person and virtually as well, to better understand kind of the advancements and where that's going. So it's, our bringing those industry partners into TechFest is also a significant part of it. So we'll have anywhere from 30 to 40 industry partners participating with us. And so again, just driving that collaboration, that connection, that awareness, because it's that incidental run-in, right? That connection that sparks a follow-on collaboration. That really makes that a powerful event for us.
that's special. You know, that collaboration, that innovation. You know, another area that we have a lot of shared passion in is the is giving back. We both are intentional there, and it matters, right? And so, as you know, here on the podcast, we give our guests the ability to gift a seat, a scholarship, if you will, in our TechLX IT Leadership Development Program, which is really cool because you've actually sent people from the lab through that program, and can't wait to hear who you've got in mind, ideally in the STEM space. Who do you think could leverage that scholarship?
Yeah, well, first of all, Dan, it's exciting for us to be able to do this. You know, we have sent cohorts through TechLX, and we're big fans of the program, and so we're honored to have the opportunity. One STEM nonprofit that stands out to us that we're going to gift this to is Girls Who Code. They do incredible work empowering young women to pursue careers in technology, and I think by providing them the scholarship, we can really help cultivate kind of the next generation of IT leadership, you know, foster diversity and innovation in our field, just recognize a really important program that's out there.
I could not agree more. That is great news, Brian. In fact, you won't be surprised, but they are a multi-time scholarship winner. So that tells you they're doing some darn good work over there.
Fantastic. Fantastic. Yeah.
Well, thank you very much, Brian. We've, you know, we're kind of coming to the end here. Luckily, it's not the end because you and I are going to work on a really cool article basically is going to talk about consumer-driven computing, or how to win through consumer-driven computing. So I want to kind of tee that up so folks can find that next week. Just Google my name, Dan Roberts, CIO.com, and that'll come up. And so, but for the audience, you know, there you have it, you know, a playbook for what matters. And you know, why focusing on the what and the why and the how matters. And so I'd like to encourage our audience, Brian, to go back and listen to this again. There's so many nuggets in there. Take notes. Make it a Sunday afternoon research project, as you would call it. And, you know, be intentional about defining what matters to you and your company right now. In fact, maybe you share with your team and have a book discussion using a podcast to do the same. And so I'd encourage people to do that. But Brian, I can't thank you enough. So many nuggets. Our audience is really fortunate to hear from you. You and I have been trying to do this for a while. Your schedule's been crazy, and again, tune in for the article on CIO.com where Brian will talk about building a truly customer-centric workforce and culture. So, Brian, thanks so much for making the time.
All right, thank you, Dan. It's been a pleasure.
Everybody, I'll keep it there. And until next time, keep focusing on what matters.
You've been listening to Tech Whispers, inside the playbook of the best digital leaders, a Woolett and Associates podcast. Keep connected with us by subscribing to the show in your favorite podcast player. If you like what you've heard, please rate the show, as this helps us connect the world's best digital leaders with those who aspire to learn, grow, and thrive in this amazing profession. Thanks for listening. Until next time.